Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
We are thinking about a big LNG project in Alaska.
The Trump administration suggests countries can ward off tariffs by investing in Alaska's gas pipeline. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 9th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, House lawmakers in Juneau struggle to find a compromise on the budget.
We need the help of the minority caucus. We also need the help of the governor to come forward and to put all these pieces together.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. If countries want to keep the Trump administration from imposing tariffs on their exports to the United States, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent suggests they invest in Alaska's liquefied natural gas project. Bessent spoke outside the White House after President Trump announced he would pause reciprocal tariffs for 90 days to allow countries to negotiate. A reporter asked Bessent what it would take for a country to block the imposition of tariffs beyond 3 months. That's when Bessent raised the Alaska project as a possible deal maker.
These are trade negotiations, but if countries want to come and offer other things, you know, I talked about yesterday that we are thinking about a big LNG project in Alaska that South Korea, Japan, Taiwan are interested in financing and taking a substantial portion of the offtake.
Bessent said a country's investment and purchase of Alaska's natural gas would help by reducing its trade imbalance with the United States. The state of Alaska has tried for years to secure investment in the project, particularly from potential customers in Asia. Cost remains a high hurdle, though. It would take an estimated $44 billion or more to build a pipeline from the North Slope to the Kenai Peninsula, with a processing plant at the north end and a liquefaction plant at the terminus. From there, LNG tankers would take the fuel across the Pacific. Countries might have more incentive to invest in Alaska LNG with the threat of tariffs hanging over them, but Trump's tariff announcements have caused global economic shocks, which could hinder investment in big projects. The Alaska legislature's quest to pass a viable state budget for this year is not getting any easier.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're all in a pickle.
That's House Speaker Bryce Edgman, a Dillingham independent. At this point, in a normal year, House lawmakers would be on the verge of passing their version of the state budget. Last year's budget passed the House on April 11th. But this is not a normal year. Lawmakers are facing big deficits in light of lower-than-expected oil prices. Meanwhile, the Democrat-heavy bipartisan majority in the House has a razor-thin margin. If minority Republicans put up a united front, majority lawmakers can't afford to lose a single vote. That's making it hard to balance the budget. Two Democratic budget writers joined with Republicans to support a roughly $3,800 permanent fund dividend. Lawmakers on both sides have called that unrealistic. Now, Edgman is pleading with his Republican counterparts for help.
We need the help of the minority caucus. We also need the help of the governor to come forward and to put all these pieces together. We still have time.
But not much. There's about a month left in the legislative session, and House leaders have yet to articulate a plan for balancing the budget. Minority House Republicans have some ideas. Palmer Republican Representative Delaina Johnson says both the PFD and the proposed $1,000 boost to basic per-student education funding will need a haircut.
We're looking at really having to cut things back, and probably going to include having to discuss both of those two very, very, very difficult things. This is not the kind of conversation that's easy to have.
But like the majority, House Republicans are not offering much in the way of specifics. Edgman says lawmakers have about a week to work out their differences and get the budget over to the Senate. The regular legislative session ends May 21st. On the hunt for oil, Hilcorp has plans this summer to barge drilling equipment up the Yukon River to the Yukon Flats, one of the most remote parts of mainland Alaska. According to the Northern Journal, the drill rig and other heavy equipment are bound for land leased by Interior Alaska Native Corporation Doyon and the local village corporation. The Northern Journal's Nat Herz says other tribal groups in the region are voicing opposition to the project, which is set to begin with a massive effort to get all of that necessary equipment about 140 miles upriver.
You hear about wildcatting. This is about as wildcatting as it gets. Like, they're bringing a drilling rig, which, like, this is multiple stories high. They need tanks. They need, I think there's like a loader that they need. They are, you know, presumably going to have trucks and other stuff. So, I mean, it's going to be many barge loads, I believe, and probably, you know, you'll see, they may end up using like a C-130 to move some stuff around. There's the potential, I think, that they might use like a heavy lift helicopter, like a Chinook, which is the one with the two blades, to be moving stuff around. So I think, like, you know, you're on the Yukon this summer between the Dalton Highway and, you know, say Fort Yukon, which is more of a larger community hub, like you're probably going to notice it might be busy.
Yeah. Well, so what are the cons to this whole thing?
Yeah, there's a whole array of tribal governments in the region that are stridently opposed to this plan. Generally speaking, like, I think it's fair to say, like, they just don't want to see oil development in this area. Like, this is an area, a region that's like really dependent on subsistence. Like, people are, you know, living on moose, on berries. That's the fear, is that there's, you know, potentially going to be some disruption there. Specifically what that disruption looks like, I mean, there are worst case scenarios that are like in the permitting documents. Like, this is the kind of work where you could end up with a blowout, which is like, you know, oil coming up out of the hole that's being drilled and going everywhere. But that doesn't happen very often. I think, like, more likely they would have like leaks from tanks of fluids or something that on the pad. People might be upset if their animals getting disrupted. So you've seen a bunch of the village tribes in the region that have put in comments opposing some of like Hillcorp's proposed actions. And then the big tribal consortium for the Interior Tananaw Chiefs Conference, they've also like issued a strong resolution just like against the program altogether.
Obviously, there are environmental concerns about this, but I mean, are those concerns any more acute because it is Hillcorp versus anybody else?
I think so. I mean, I think Hillcorp certainly, I think, have been in the news much more because they've had more accidents, more leak type situations than like maybe some of the other large oil companies operating in Alaska. I think in part that's because Hillcorp buys and operates older stuff that is more inclined to kind of leak or have an accident. One of the things that I find really interesting here is that, like, I think Alaskans know Hillcorp as a company that is best at buying older, aging oil fields and sort of doing techniques to like wring a little bit more oil out of them in ways that like some of the bigger companies that used to own them, that they aren't really able to do. They're not really known for, again, wildcatting, like going out way to a place like where there has never been any oil found and like punching a hole in the ground and like finding it. That's not really their thing. And so that is part of what's driving, I think, a little bit of the anxiety and the opposition here, is that this is a company that I think a lot of people in the region don't trust.
You mentioned, you know, the likelihood of future development if they do discover oil there. Does anybody know at this point what that would look like? I mean, are we talking like roads all the way out there or what?
Well, they're not going to put the money in to do that unless it's a big oil field, right? Because you got to get paid back for those tens or almost certainly hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. And so doubtful that you would see like a road going through like the Yukon Flats Wildlife Refuge, but would you see a lot of stuff getting barged up the Yukon, and would you need a pipeline going probably through a wildlife refuge or the White Mountains as an important recreational area for Fairbanks residents? That I think would be like the real fight over, you know, can this actually be built? But I think, you know, certainly the folks that are involved in the drilling effort and pushing this forward would say, like, we're not there yet. We really don't know yet if there's even any oil here whatsoever. And I mean, I do think the upside is interesting, right? Like, it does explain why you have Doyon and also the tribal government in the village of Birch Creek, which is the closest one to where they would be doing this, about 10 to 15 miles away. It's like, you know, they have the potential to get really big dividends paid out, which is, you know, I think some people see as really important in to sustain rural remote communities. And then there's also like the potential that the way the leases are structured between Hillcorp and the landowners, the native corporations, like if there's oil found and they build stuff, the locals are going to get hired, and Doyon's subsidiary companies that do work in the oil industry and other industries, like they're going to get hired. So there is like, you know, that's, I think, a big selling point.
That was Nat Herz with the Northern Journal, which you can find at northernjournal.com. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new ship in Kodiak honors one of the Coast Guard's pioneering black commanders.
Captain Witherspoon lived by a simple yet powerful mantra: learn, think, then act. These words serve as a guiding principle.
That's ahead. Stay with us. Alaska Head Start programs are reeling after the regional federal office was suddenly closed last week, leaving programs uncertain about grant administration and future funding. The Alaska Beacon reports U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. ordered the closure of five of the nation's 12 regional offices. That included the Seattle-based Region 10 office serving Alaska, Washington, Idaho, and Oregon. It was part of an agency-wide consolidation that also included cutting 10,000 employees. The federal department did not respond to a request for comment on Tuesday, nor did the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. The office was a critical resource for Alaska Head Start programs for grant administration and compliance. Head Start provides early learning programs through schools and nonprofits that serve children from low-income families, supporting pregnant mothers and kids up to age 5. There was no immediate news of cuts or closures, and there have not been Head Start funding delays reported in Alaska yet. The Alaska Humanities Forum faces a massive cut to its budget after the Trump administration's slashing of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The more than 50-year-old organization uses federal money combined with matching dollars from local grants and donations to fund programs around the state aimed at bringing communities together. Cameron Perez-Verdia is president and CEO of the Humanities Forum.
Youth programs that are happening around the state. It's programs that are doing language preservation. It's grants that are doing historical projects.
Last Wednesday, the forum received a letter from the National Endowment for the Humanities that its federal grant, totaling about $900,000, was terminated, effective April 1st. And Alaska isn't alone. Last week, humanities programs in all 50 states that rely on the National Endowment received notice that the White House's Department of Government Efficiency, also known as DOGE, aims to cancel roughly $175 million in grant funding that had not yet been disbursed. Perez-Verdia says the short notice is troubling, and his organization is exploring legal options to get its funding restored.
We believe that this is an illegal action. It's funding that was already granted. Our organization and all of these councils are in charter. So these are in our U.S. law that our organization exists and gets funded.
Perez-Verdia says if the funding is not restored, it would be very difficult to raise local funds to make up the loss.
To be able to raise this kind of money is going to be really challenging. We as an organization would have to restructure significantly, and we would lose a lot.
Representatives from the offices of Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan and Congressman Nick Begich did not immediately respond to a request for comment. However, Perez-Verdia says the state's congressional delegation has expressed support for the Alaska Humanities Forum, and he believes the funding will be restored. The fate of a young man behind the wheel in a 2019 Unalaska car crash that killed two teens is in the hands of an Anchorage jury. As KUCB's Maggie Nelson reports, attorneys spent almost an entire day Monday presenting their closing arguments in the case.
24-year-old Dustin Ruckman faces two counts of criminally negligent homicide for his involvement in the deaths of 16-year-old Carly McDonald and 18-year-old Kiara Renteria Haste in Unalaska in 2019. Both the prosecutor and Ruckman's defense attorney agree that his actions caused the girls' deaths, but whether he was negligent in the eyes of the law is up to the jury. Ruckman's defense attorney, Julia Mowdy, says it's a tricky situation.
Two girls died. Dustin Ruckman made a mistake. There is nobody who is saying, I'm certainly not saying, that that Dustin Ruckman is not at fault for their death.
Mowdy faced off against prosecutors in an Anchorage courtroom over the past couple weeks, both sides painting the picture of what happened 6 years ago. In early May of 2019, when Ruckman was 18, he drove his truck up on Alaska's Mount Ballyhoo with McDonald and Renteria Haste as passengers. The truck eventually plummeted down the Yalaktahead cliff side of the mountain with the two girls inside. They were ejected and died in the fall. Ruckman sustained some minor injuries and told police that he was thrown from the truck. The court attempted to find a group of Unalaska jurors last month, but failed to find enough impartial candidates, so the case was sent to Anchorage. Nearly 300 people tuned in to the live stream of the trial Monday as attorneys presented closing arguments, which fixated mainly on the legal definition of criminal negligence. About 25 members of the public attended in person, including Ruckman's parents and the parents of both victims. The mood was quiet and somber, and some shed tears as videos of the day of the incident were played for the jury. Assistant District Attorney Patrick McKay Jr. agreed with Mowdy that the situation is tragic, but he told the jury even accidental conduct can be criminal.
Really, ladies and gentlemen, I think this case comes down to criminal negligence.
McKay pointed to witness testimony from Ruckman's close friend, Luke Shishnikov, who had testified during the trial that the pathway where Ruckman's truck fell down the mountain requires the driver to make a sharp turn, quote, to stay alive, as Shishnikov put it. McKay says Ruckman was aware of the risk because he'd driven on the pathway several times before.
Ladies and gentlemen, I submit to you, you're driving in that area and you have to take a hard left to avoid going over a 900-foot cliff. That is a substantial and unjustifiable risk for yourself and for anybody in that vehicle with you. And that is exactly what Dustin Ruckman did on May 9th of 2019 when he brought Kiara Renteria Haste and Carly McDonald up to Yalaktahead on their lunch break.
McKay says Ruckman either failed to perceive the risk or disregarded it, making his behavior criminal, even if it was accidental. Mowdy disagrees. She says Ruckman had indeed made a mistake, but his actions did not rise to the level of criminal negligence.
Criminal negligence is when the fault is so great, the error is so great, the disregard in advance, not in hindsight, but in advance of what the person is doing, is such a gross deviation of the standard of care that every other person would take that it's deserving of criminal liability.
Mowdy says there were insufficient signs or blockades in the area that could have kept drivers away from the cliff's edge or the roads and pathways on top of the mountain. She says prior to the crash, there was nothing in place that explicitly pointed to the danger of driving in the area or that would have made Ruckman's actions illegal. Mowdy also returned to a narrative she presented earlier in the trial about the community's feelings towards Ruckman after the crash.
And you've also heard that instead of celebrating that Dustin Ruckman miraculously lived, there were people in the community who would rather he had died on that mountain than survived that crash.
McKay, the state prosecutor, had the final say Monday. He told jurors that most of the facts of the case had been established within a half hour of law enforcement arriving on scene, long before most of the community was aware of the incident. Superior Court Judge Thomas Matthews handed the case over to jurors for deliberation Monday afternoon. Reporting for KUCB, I'm Maggie Nelson.
State legislators grilled two University of Alaska Board of Regents appointees at a Senate Education Committee meeting last week as part of their confirmation process. That's after the board approved a motion to scrub mentions of diversity, equity, and inclusion from university communications in February. As KTOO's Jamie Deep reports, some lawmakers criticized the board's decision.
A February vote from the board to remove mentions of DEI has brought up criticism about the decision itself and the lack of transparency in the process. Anchorage Senator Lukey Tobin criticized the decision during last week's Senate Education meeting. Tobin is a Democrat and is also a PhD student at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. She says the board should have heard from the university community before making the decision.
I have had my faith shaken over the last few weeks. It has been deeply shaken. And I know many of my fellow colleagues and fellow students are feeling similar. We are feeling unheard. We are feeling unseen.
The University of Alaska Board of Regents is composed of 11 members. Each regent serves 8-year terms, except for the student regent, who serves for 2 years. Members are appointed by the governor before going through a confirmation process with the legislature. Only one of the two appointees being considered was actually at the meeting. Anchorage-based regent Christine Ressler was appointed for her first term this year. She voted in favor of the motion to scrub DEI mentions from the university.
I stand behind that we were trying to do the right thing, but I also recognize how hard it was for the community.
Senator Jesse Kuehl, a Juneau Democrat, says the decision gives the federal government a lot of power over the university.
It doesn't just say we're going to follow the U.S. Constitution or federal law. It says any guidance, any executive orders or guidance on executive orders that come out of the federal government, anything from the U.S. Department of Education on Maryland Avenue in Washington, D.C., is the law of the University of Alaska system.
Ressler says she's committed to supporting the UA community through any other changes from the federal government.
We are in a very dynamic environment, and I can't predict what's going to happen next or what we're going to be faced with. But what I can tell you is I will make sure the Board of Regents will react to support the students, the faculty, and the alumni of the state and the university system.
Regent Karen Perdue was reappointed this year. She wasn't at the meeting when the board approved the motion, but says that the university needs to maintain a stable environment to face what comes from the federal government.
We see directives coming out sometimes on short notice, but what we can do is we can stick together, talk to each other, and try to figure out how we might react and best adapt to these activities. I value the principles of academic freedom and the right to speak about issues. These are core values of our university.
Senate President Gary Stevens, a Kodiak Republican, is the only other senator that questioned the appointees, but he asks about accreditation and research within the system. Ressler and Purdue's confirmations will be heard at the joint legislative session that has yet to be scheduled. In Juneau, I'm Jamie Deep.
The first of 3 new Coast Guard fast response cutters to be homeported in Kodiak is officially ready for duty. KMXT's Davis Hovey attended the commissioning ceremony last week for the John Witherspoon at Coast Guard Base Kodiak and has this story.
Dozens of Coast Guard members and civilians dressed in blue military suits, blazers, and dresses filled rows of temporary seating inside the Air Station Kodiak's main hangar. The official commissioning of the cutter John Witherspoon included speeches from Coast Guard top brass, including Rear Admiral Megan Dean, the commander of the 17th District.
Captain Witherspoon lived by a simple yet powerful mantra: learn, think, then act. These words serve as a guiding principle, reminding us each that thoughtful leadership, critical thinking, and decisive action are the cornerstone of excellence.
John Witherspoon, the cutter's namesake, was the first African-American to command a medium endurance cutter. His officers often called him Papa Spoon, and many of them were affectionately referred to as his teaspoons. The John Witherspoon first arrived in Kodiak in January and has been maneuvering in nearby bays while the crew gets familiar with the vessel before it is deployed for its first mission. The commissioning means it's now ready for active service. Regina Nash is Witherspoon's daughter. She was one of a few family members in attendance for the ceremony and was named as the vessel's sponsor. She says her father, who passed away in the 1990s, included the Coast Guard as part of his family.
Everybody here on the Coast Guard base and everybody who put this whole thing together had treat me like royalty. And like they always say, and you, if you can talk to any Coast Guard person, it's family. This is a big family, and I'm proud to be part of it, and it's an honor to be here.
This cutter is the first of 3 to be homeported in Kodiak. Each new vessel is named after individuals that leadership deem as exemplary Coast Guard members and heroes. As part of the April 3rd ceremony, Witherspoon's nephew, Troy Patterson, presented the long glass to the roughly 25-member crew, which signifies the officer of the deck's authority on the ship and helps set up the vessel's first watch. The commissioning ceremony concluded with another Coast Guard tradition, raising the colors.
And so the colors of commissioning pennant are flying over United States Coast Guard cutter John Weatherspoon.
Lieutenant Caitlin Lane is the John Weatherspoon's executive officer. She says the operational schedule has not been determined yet, but the cutter will be patrolling around the Gulf of Alaska, Bering Sea Aleutians, and potentially Cook Inlet.
We want to be localized in an area where we are supporting the fishermen as best as we can. And so it definitely is an ever-changing sort of area of operations.
The John Weatherspoon is 154 feet in length, can travel at a speed of more than 28 knots, and has the capacity to remain at sea for longer periods of time than the decommissioned island-class patrol boats. The cutter is set to begin operations in the coming weeks. Reporting from Air Station Kodiak, I'm Davis Hovey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone and Jamie Deep in Juneau, Liz Ruskin and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Maggie Nelson in Unalaska, and Davis Hovey in Kodiak. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.